This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Pleased you are starting your week with us, and our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. One of our favorite guests is here, and his name is Philip Manuel, the fabulous singer from New Orleans, who through the years has logged a lot of quality time in places like Geno's in Baton Rouge and at the LSU Music School and at many other venues where he has performed not only in Louisiana, but all over the country. We talked with him a few months ago, and he was just back from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he's here with us to talk about some significant losses the world of entertainment has experienced just in the last few days. And it's always a pleasure to share the microphone with the golden voice of Philip Manuel. Good morning, Philip.
Hey, Jim. I'm so glad to be here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And for those who missed our last conversation, Philip plays well anywhere he goes, and I heard you got quite a response in Ann Arbor.
It was fantastic, man. Yeah, it was really, the club was just a super great venue to play at. The audience was extremely receptive. We did a bunch of the new record that I've just recorded with Adonis Rose, the artistic director of the Nojo Orchestra, and it was well received.
Well, Frankie Beverly, who Philip knew well, the husky-voiced, white-clad soul singer from Philadelphia, that's the way Keith Sparrow of The Advocate and Picayune put him. He enjoyed a decade-long love affair with New Orleans and died September 10th, just a few days ago. He was 77 years old, and for a multiple generation of black fans, the music of Mays was ingrained in their lives, the soundtrack to countless social events. And Philip Manuel, you were affected dramatically by this man.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think any city in America responded to Frankie like we did. I think I've even heard him say that New Orleans was his second home. And it certainly, they had a big second line here just the other day for him.
I heard. Amazing.
It was attended by thousands of people. It was incredible. But I actually got to know Frankie just a little bit when it was after Katrina. He couldn't do his regular concert here, and he did his Essence Festival concert in Houston. But when he finally did get back to New Orleans later that year, everybody at the concert wore white in honor of him, because he always wore white when he came here. I thought it was coincidental. In Houston, he wore red. He didn't wear his usual white, but when he came back here, he wore white. So I wrote a piece in the paper about, and it was called "And They All Wore White." Mm. And it was just a piece about him and about how we love him and how he, you know, we tried to honor him and his music by coming wearing white. And a few weeks later, I get an email or a phone call, I don't remember which, and it was Frankie Beverly. And he told me how no one had ever written such a nice piece about him, you know, such a great piece about him, which I doubted. I'm sure he's had many great pieces written about him. But he was really, really taken by the piece. And we kind of got to be email friends for a little while. And at his next show here, I you know, my wife and I had front row seats, and we actually got to visit with him in his dressing room and talk with him and get to know him a little bit. It was quite a wonderful experience.
Well, Frankie, as Philip notes, performed in New Orleans the final time May 25th. And to put that in perspective, that's just 4.5 months before he died. Mays headlined a sold-out Smoothie King Center. Most of the 14,000 fans, as Philip suggested and implored, wore white to match Beverly's traditional stage attire. He was born Howard Stanley Beverly, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, where he sang gospel and doo-wop in his youth. And like many singers, particularly black singers, he had a history in churches, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did. That's where he got his start, kind of like me.
Right.
People don't know that, but I actually started singing in my aunt's church, Mount Moriah Baptist Church here in New Orleans. And of course, I sang with my father sitting on his lap as a child. That was really my introduction to singing. But, you know, my first live performances were certainly in church.
Well, his group came to the attention many years ago. Obviously, it's many years ago because Marvin Gaye's been dead for 40. But Marvin Gaye was a big part of Frankie's development, wasn't he?
He was. He heard them, and I think they had moved to San Francisco in like 1970. They left Philadelphia, and the band at the time was called Raw Soul, I believe. And Marvin Gaye heard them, and actually, he used the band as an opening act for some of his shows. And he suggested that they change their name to Maze, which they did. And after that, they did 9 gold or platinum albums. And the rest, as people say, is history.
And Keith Sparra notes that Frankie apparently made his first appearance on stage in New Orleans in 1978, so that's 46 years ago, at Municipal Auditorium. So that would be, he would have been like 30, 31 years old at the time.
Wow.
And as you know, he had a long history with the city.
Yeah, he did. You know, he did one of his most famous albums here, the Live at the Sanger album.
Live at the Sanger. And talk about a great venue.
I think that was 1980.
Venue.
Yeah. Or so, and it that's one of his very best albums. I mean, he's a band who, you know, some bands aren't as good live as they are on record. He was better live than he was on record, and his records were always phenomenal. But live, he was just super.
Well, Robin Dow, our producer, who's all of 26 years old, knows Frankie Beverly, who of course, started well before she was born, but Robin has chosen the selection for us to play of those who are familiar and perhaps those who would like to be familiar with Frankie Beverly and Maze. Quite a performer, quite a voice, quite a stage presence.
He was super, man.
Now, a listener notes that he closed the first 15 Essence Fests. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
He was the closing act.
And
kind of like the Neville Brothers always closed out Jazz Fest, he always closed out the Essence Festival.
That's right. And Maze returned to New Orleans after Katrina, almost a year later, and also a sold-out crowd of 14,000.
Yeah.
Filled what was called the New Orleans Arena for an emotional night, and during the encore, Frankie Beverly reached down to clasp hands with fans who grabbed hold and wouldn't let go, and his voice cracked with emotion as he continued to sing. He said to Keith Sparrow, "I almost lost it. I almost lost it." As you say, he truly, as just about anybody does who comes to New Orleans and is in the arts, they love your city, and I guess my city too. I was born there too.
There you go.
There you go. And I'll take it. I don't mind telling anybody that I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana.
And I didn't know that, Jim.
Yeah, I sure was. I had Mercy Hospital.
Wow. So, on Bienville and Jeff, well, what's now Norman C. Francis.
And which hospital for you, Philip Manuel? A few years.
I was born at Flint Goodrich. on the corner of Ferret and Louisiana Avenue.
And we were both born before the Louis Armstrong Airport was in existence. Didn't it start?
Absolutely.
We had a listener at the last time we talked about this in 64, I believe, something like that's when it then Moisant Field. But the old Lakefront Airport was where people would fly in and out. And And New Orleans, according to some, missed an opportunity because we were the same size as Houston, Dallas, and Atlanta in the 60s, and we didn't grow like they did. And they were all hubs for airlines, and maybe we missed an opportunity. But for those who haven't gone, the new airport is really a fine place to fly in and out of. It is sensational. And we're going to spend some more time with Philip Manuel. We'll talk about three other big losses this month. The month of September is one to remember for all the wrong reasons, and we'll talk about some of the greats we lost. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing in another segment with the great singer from New Orleans, Philip Manuel, who is still going and has a lot of gas left in the tank, and we lost some great ones. And when this happens, it's sobering. And we talked about Frankie Beverly, and I'm a few years away, but I think you just crossed the mark, Philip. Tito Jackson, founder of the Jackson Five, along with his dad, but he was the third of nine children, and he was really the top Jackson, and Michael was the most famous, but Tito was the power behind the throne, the other brothers, Jackie, Jermaine, Marlon, and Michael, but he died at 70 the other day. And
which is where I am right now.
70 years old, yeah.
And we were just a couple of months apart in our birthdays.
But the Jackson 5, I remember in 1970 when I was 12, they came out of nowhere. I think their first four hits were number ones. Nobody's ever done that, but they did.
Yep.
And they took, there were the Osmonds who were popular, but then there were the Jacksons, and oh my goodness, the country immediately embraced this family from Gary, Indiana. Tell us about the Jackson 5 legacy and Tito's contribution.
Well, you said right. They had like four hits, one right after the other. I Want You Back, I'll Be There, ABC. And I forget what the other one was, but you know, they came out of the gate really hard, really fast, and Tito was a pretty accomplished guitar player. I understand that he picked up his father's guitar when he was a kid and broke a string, and after that his father bought him a guitar and he started playing, and he really became accomplished. Even though they would never let him play on the records, he became a pretty accomplished guitar player. But they came out really strong, and I mean, you can't ignore their legacy and what they meant to American popular music.
Well, you were right. The first four that the singles that they produced were all number ones, and it was "I Want You Back," "ABC," "The Love You Save," "And I'll Be There."
Oh, yeah. And I'll Be There.
And, of course, Michael Jackson had many number ones as a single artist, but do you know they never had another number one? The Jackson 5?
You mean the Jackson 5 after
those first four, that was it.
Wow.
Isn't that something? But
I did not know that.
But 26-year-old Robin Dow has chosen her favorite Jackson song, and this one made it to number two. Number two in the late early 71, actually. Early 71,
right.
And it was number one R&B, but number two on Billboard. It is Robin. There we go.
Yeah.
That's 12-year-old. 12-year-old Michael Jackson.
I actually used to sound like that.
I did too. I did. When I was 12.
When I was a youngster, my voice was really high like that. It was amazing. And it's amazing how your voice changes as you get older. I bet you don't know who wrote that song, Never Can Say Goodbye.
I don't. Who wrote it?
Clifton Davis, the actor.
Really?
He was in a comedy show, a sitcom called That's My Mama. I don't know whether you remember that.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember. Yeah.
Yep. He was in that show. He played the son, and he wrote Never Can Say Goodbye.
Well, the music they did, and that's why they were so good, is that it's held up. And those were the early Jackson songs, And it just blows me away to think that Michael Jackson has now been dead for 15 years. But
since 2009, wasn't it?
Yep, June 25th, same day that Farrah Fawcett died. But 58, wow. The year I was born, produced Michael Jackson, Prince, and Madonna, all in the summer of 58.
Wow.
But a group that I grew up listening to, and I'm sure Philip did as well, Sergio Santos Mendes, born in Brazil. He died September 5th in Los Angeles. And for those in the 60s, Brazil 66, which became Brazil 77, they had a catalog of classics, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean... Their first big hit, I think, was Mais Que Nada, and then they did The Look of Love. They did Fool on a Hill. I you know, being a musician, of course, I got into all types of music, and they were certainly one of the groups that I listened to. And they also did a song called Nothing Will Be As It Was. I don't know who wrote that song, but that was one of my favorites, always has been.
Well, they too also dominated the charts, and they had a number of hits, one after the other, and the person who sang on most of them was Lanny Hall, who's married to Herb Alpert, who will be 89 shortly, and he is still performing. I saw they have a performance, he and Lanny, in Houston in December, but... Brazil 66, now you mentioned some of their top songs. And 26-year-old Robin Dow has chosen the song that I think is Frank Sinatra's best among many, Night and Day, written by Cole Porter. But they did a great rendition. Here it is, Robin's choice for Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66.
It's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you.
Night and day, why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go?
Pretty smooth. Almost as smooth as Philip Manuel. They were something. We're short on time, but January 17th is the birthday of the great Muhammad Ali, who was the seminal figure of my youth, but it's also the birthday of The Voice, a man who had as much power in his voice as Muhammad Ali did in his fist, James Earl Jones, and he died the 9th of this month. And anybody who appreciates vocal power, as you and I do, Philip, has to have reverence for James Earl Jones.
Absolutely. Born in Arca Butler, Mississippi. I mean, the paper said he was born by the light of an oil lamp in a cabin in Arca Butler, Mississippi. What a poetic beginning and small beginning for a person who became bigger than life.
And he was a graduate. Philip was an Ann Arbor, Michigan graduate of the University of Michigan, a really bright guy, a great actor. And, of course, he was known for The Voice, and he showcased that voice, and often at very little reward for himself. But Perhaps his most famous vocal presentation was for the fledgling network started by Ted Turner in 1980.
This is CNN.
Yeah.
This is CNN.
Pretty good stuff, James Earl Jones. The voice will live forever.
Yeah.
As will yours, Philip. And thank you. It's always an honor to share the microphone with one of the great talents from New Orleans who's still going, and we'll be talking, I'm sure, later this year with Philip Manuel. Thanks again, my friend.
Thank you, Jim.
Back with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. We're pleased you're starting your week with us, and Robin Dow is producing. This show was produced a few hours before showtime. As we speak, your host is en route to Minnesota, but in studio at the crack of dawn, it's now 9:30 Central Time, at the crack of dawn is Jan Moeller, who for about 13 years has headed the group that was the budget project, the Louisiana Budget Project, now Invest in Louisiana. And he was for just about the same amount of years.
About 9 years.
9 years. Times-Picayune, he worked hand in glove with one Robert Travis Scott.
Yes.
And
still a good friend.
Well, and they were really a dynamic duo. I talked the other day about how the Advocate misses the editorial tandem of Lanny Keller and Danny Heitman, the Lanny and Danny team. When Robert and Jan were covering the Capitol, you did it with great aplomb, as they would say. You did a great job.
Thank you. That's very nice of you to say. It was, for my money, the state government beat is the best in journalism, and really enjoyed my time with the Times-Picayune, and it was always interesting up there.
Well, you have been at the Capitol now wearing your Invest in Louisiana hat, and there's all kinds of talk about the governor's tax plan and what in the heck's going on.
Well, we learn a little bit more with each passing week, but there's still a lot we don't know. Here's what we do know, Jim, about the tax and budget problem, is that the state is facing a $500 million or more fiscal cliff next year. What that means is if the legislature does nothing at all between now and July 1st, we have about $500 million falling out of the state revenue tax base, which is going to require that amount of money in cuts to programs and services. And we know that Governor Landry and Richard Nelson, his Secretary of Revenue, want to use this fiscal cliff as kind of a pretext to do a comprehensive tax reform plan. And that's what Nelson has been going around the state talking about. Unfortunately, so far, what we've heard from Nelson is a lot about the taxes that he wants to cut. He wants to cut income taxes on individuals, particularly the wealthy. He wants to cut taxes on corporations. He wants to get rid of the corporate franchise tax. If you take a $500 million budget shortfall and you start cutting taxes, you're going to end up with a much deeper budget shortfall. And so what we haven't heard as many details about from the administration is what taxes they would propose to raise or what loopholes they want to close in order to make up that gap. Because the state, as you know, and listeners probably know, has to balance the budget every single year. And so if you cut taxes, if you don't fill the fiscal cliff, you're going to be cutting the budget, and I don't think that's something legislators are eager to do.
We're hearing the voice of Jan Moeller, who is the person in charge at the Invest in Louisiana outfit, which is a watchdog group that often is portrayed as leaning left. But on an issue like this, I don't know left or right. And the governor, of course, is getting some conservative stalwarts who are saying, hey, wait a minute. These tax exemptions, they like a lot, don't they?
Those tax exemptions are there for a reason. People like those. And we're talking about things like the film subsidy program, a program that we've frankly been critical of at our organization. But I think politicians on the left and right enjoy the film program and the movie productions it brings to our state that cost about $150 million a year. There's the quality jobs tax break program that underwrites payroll for certain manufacturing companies and other companies that come into Louisiana. That's another $130, $140 million a year. That's one of those programs that our economic development folks really love because they think it brings in business. But I think it's and one thing that I think people on the left, center, and right agree with is that despite all the rhetoric we hear, Louisiana is still a low-tax state. When you compare our tax burden here in Louisiana to most states, we raise less money on a per capita basis. We raise less money as a percentage of the overall economy than most states. And we also have a tax system that's upside down. When you look at what percentage of your income goes to pay your state and local taxes, people at the very top actually pay a much lower rate than people at the middle and bottom. And that's because, frankly, our income taxes is lower than most states, and our sales taxes are a lot higher than most states.
Well, the governor has an eye for talent, and there's no doubt that the Revenue Secretary Richard Nelson is a comer. He ran for governor, but he's a charismatic, persuasive man, and he has a point of view that he truly believes in. He's not faking this. He believes it. But he's also a realist, and I love this quote that was in last Thursday's paper in a story by Tyler Bridges. We can't have a tax cut on a tax cut. So he knows that what you talked about is that at some point you can't cut your way to prosperity.
Absolutely. And look, there's not a single legislator that I'm aware of who ran for office promising to cut funding for LSU, cut funding for teacher pay, cut money for health care or public safety or any of the other things that our tax dollars pay for. Those cuts are painful. Ask anybody who lived through the Jindal years in the legislature. I don't think anybody enjoyed those cuts. And so when you start talking about tax reform, if you're going to do it in what's called a revenue neutral fashion, you know, so you're going to raise just about the same amount of money, maybe a little bit less, but you're just going to change the structure of the tax code. Well, then you're talking about somebody's going to pay more and somebody's going to pay less. Well, the person who's going to pay less is going to be pretty happy, but somebody's going to end up paying more. And those are the folks who I think you're going to hear from at the Capitol. And so that's what makes this very difficult. In order to pass a new tax, in order to raise more revenue to make up for these tax cuts that are being proposed, you need 70 votes in the House. That's a two-thirds supermajority. In the Senate, you need a two-thirds supermajority as well. That's 26. That's a tough threshold, especially when these chambers are dominated by conservative Republicans who don't want to have tax increase votes on their resume. So Richard Nelson, I agree with you, is a very bright man, very committed to his point of view, very accessible. He's out there talking to anybody and everybody about this. But I think Richard Nelson would be the first to tell you he has an enormous challenge ahead of him in tax reform. This is something that's been tried several times over the years, and it seldom ends up the way it's drawn up on paper.
Well, Republican lawmakers say they want the 0.45 cent sales tax, which is going to expire on June 30th, to disappear. But that's an estimated $455 million in revenue. So that's a hole right there that, as you say, the fiscal cliff. What happens if action is not taken? Does higher education then suddenly, and healthcare, do those continue to be the places where the cuts go?
Absolutely. Well, we know that discretionary dollars in the state budget, the money that legislators actually control, because so much of it is kind of automatic and non-discretionary, as they say in budget terms, the discretionary dollars go heavily to healthcare and higher education in particular. So those are the areas that tend to get cut. When we went through this in the 2010s under Jindal, Louisiana led the country in cuts to higher education. The result of that was that tuition and fees went up dramatically. So the cost of an LSU education or a community college education falls much harder now on students and families than it did before those cuts. The same thing is true of healthcare. To their credit, the administration and the legislature has started holding hearings, and this is unprecedented in my experience. I've been around 21 years in Louisiana, and they're already holding hearings in the budget committee on next year's budget. The current year budget only started 2.5 months ago, and they're already holding hearings on the FY26 budget. They're calling up agencies and asking them, how would you respond? How would you react if we asked you to cut your budget by X amount? And what we're hearing is that those cuts would be really severe. They had the health department up there a couple of weeks ago, And they said, well, if we have to cut $100 million, we're going to have to cut some of these optional services, home care services for elderly and people with disabilities that allow people to stay in their homes as an alternative of going to nursing homes, programs that help at-risk kids. These are programs, I don't know of a single legislator who wants to see the state get rid of those. So, yeah, the cuts are going to be painful if the state doesn't resolve this fiscal cliff with revenue.
Well, Richard Nelson, when he was running for governor, proposed doing away completely with the state income tax. And now we have a modification of that, but it would result in a, quote, flat tax. And the question is whether this flat tax would hurt people at the lower ends and benefit people at the higher end. And I know that's something you follow closely, but some people who have looked at the numbers say that the deduction, the standard deduction would take care of those at the low end. Is that true, or is that just a hope that can be papered over?
Well, it actually is true. I think we did an analysis of, Secretary Nelson has put out two ideas about a flat tax, and the idea is to raise the standard deduction. So you're really not talking about a flat tax. You're talking about two brackets, a 0% bracket and then a second bracket, and he's talked about making that at 3.5% or 3.8% income tax bracket as a flat tax bracket. If you go with 3.5% with the larger standard deduction, that 0% bracket that he talked about, we put out a study last week and shows that the total cost of that would be about $1.1 billion. If you put it at 3.8%, the cost is about $750 million. You add that on top of the fiscal cliff, you've got a big hole in the budget. You are well over $1 billion. So, yes, people would get a tax cut, but there would be a huge price to pay for that. And the question everybody needs to be asking is, what taxes are you prepared to raise to make up for this lost revenue?
We're going to continue with Jan Moeller after this. 877-217-5757 is our normal number, but it isn't today because this is a tape segment. But Jan Moeller is, of course, the guy who knows the budget about as well as anybody. He started as a journalist, 9 years Picayune, and now 13 years Louisiana Budget Project, which has changed its moniker to Invest in Louisiana. And we'll talk about the implications of a flat tax and whether it would break the budget. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and hope your week's off to a great start. Robin Dow producing, and we're closing the hour with the man who knows the budget better than anybody. His group used to be called the Louisiana Budget Project, and now Jan Moeller is head of Invest in Louisiana, and a rose by any other name is still a rose. And he is the person who really can crunch the numbers better than anybody I know, and he says that if we tweak the income tax the way the Secretary of Revenue would like, Richard Nelson, that it'd make about a $750 million hole in the budget. I think Nelson says it'd be about $500 million, but you add that with the one half cent tax that's rolling off, we're in the billion-dollar territory or more. And you gotta do something to keep the trains rolling. And understand that a November special session is in the works. Can they resolve all this, or is this a train going nowhere?
You know, that's the billion-dollar question, Jim. If you remember, Governor Landry at first wanted to do a lot of this work in a constitutional convention. That was the plan during the spring regular session. He wanted to rewrite the entire state constitution during the last 2 weeks of the regular session. That idea passed the House, but it couldn't gain any traction in the Senate. Then in June, we kept hearing that they want to do a constitutional rewrite, maybe not a whole convention, but they want to do this in a July and August special session. That idea couldn't get off the ground either. The latest idea, again, is to hold a special session of the legislature to make some constitutional changes and to cut the income tax and make some other changes. We still don't have all the details, but we know they want to meet after the November 5th election, but before Thanksgiving. So they're looking at a November special session, but we still don't know if, they need to put out a plan. I don't think the Senate as I understand it, is going to want to come in and do that work unless they have a very detailed plan. They know what they're going to be asked to vote on, and they need to count the votes and make sure that they have the support that they need to do this. And so what Secretary Nelson said last week when he met with the tax committees in the House and Senate is that their intention is to have the income tax cuts made during the session take effect on January 1st, but then also pass some constitutional changes that would be voted on in March 29th. But the problem, I think, is, you know, what if those constitutional changes don't pass? Then you've cut the income tax, but you don't have the ability to make up the revenue, and now all of a sudden you have you've turned a fiscal problem into a budget crisis, because now you really do have those $1 billion, $2 billion shortfalls in state government.
In Tyler Bridges' story last week, he notes that the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, which is a nonprofit in Washington, reports that Louisiana has a regressive tax system. People who earn less than $18,000 pay over 13% of their family income in taxes, while people who earn over $550,000 pay about half that much. And some people believe that that's okay, but others say, hey, you know, if we really want to have a rising tide lift all boats, we have to do something. So is the governor on the right track to doing something?
Well, I think something in this case, you're exactly right. Our tax system is upside down, and we don't ask wealthy people and corporations to pay their fair share. And that's really what we're asking, is if we want to have strong schools, good hospitals, good roads, safe communities, we need to pay for them somehow. And I think most people would agree is that the people who've really profited and done the best in our economy should pay at least as much as a share of their income as people who are struggling to make ends meet. The reason we have this upside-down tax structure, as we talked about earlier, is that our sales taxes in Louisiana are extremely high. That's when you combine the state and local sales tax. Our income taxes are very low compared to most states, and we have extremely low property taxes. And so we have, you know, two out of the three legs of the stool are shorter than that one sales tax leg. And people with low incomes, that sales tax is the main thing they pay, because every dollar that they make goes, you know, gets spent in the community. Our concern, and we haven't done all the research because we haven't seen the plan, is that what is being put out there would actually make the situation worse, would push the tax burden away from people at the top of the income ladder and push it towards folks in the middle and bottom.
Well, we're going to see what happens, and it'll be fascinating. But Governor Jindal, before the legs came off the table, before he hit the skids, he proposed a sales tax, 3% increase. Wasn't that what we were talking about?
A 3 percentage point increase.
And get rid of the income tax, and it went absolutely nowhere.
I remember it well. That was one of the first big tax fights we had under Jindal. If you remember, and he got reelected in 2011, and then in 2012, and he had Republican majorities, you know, solid Republican majorities for the first time. In 2012, we had a big fight over the school vouchers. That was ultimately successful for the governor. And then right after that, he announced that tax reform was going to be his big initiative for 2013. And he did propose to get rid of the income tax. That's been the kind of the North Star goal of conservatives in Louisiana for many years. But once he put the math out, it turns out the math didn't math right. And it wasn't popular with, certainly not with progressives, but a lot of conservatives too, realized that that sales tax would hit businesses, would hit everybody really hard, and would still require deep cuts to the budget. So if you remember, Jim, he had to park that plan on the day of the session.
He opened the session by parking his own plan.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of the beginning of Jindal's second term. I think, you know, anybody would admit that things kind of went awry for Bobby Jindal, his second go-round, and I think that tax plan was a big part of it.
Well, some creative thinking is good, and Richard Nelson is a creative thinker, and I think the governor made a good choice in having him as his revenue secretary. But a listener, before we started a conversation today, reminded me of a plan that Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser had for improving our roads. And it is an outside-the-box thought, and some people debunk it immediately, but he says, raise the gas tax real high, but if you're from Louisiana, you can send in your receipts and get a refund. So we would only be taxing people out of state. That's creative thinking, John Mueller.
You know, I hadn't heard of that plan. I think that's interesting. Probably a big paperwork hassle for the Department of Revenue. You know, Richard Nelson would need a lot more staff to deal
probably
with that.
Probably would. But people in Louisiana, that we say, you know, if you go down I-10, look at all the traffic that is not Louisiana traffic. That's the biggest roadway in America. And maybe Nungesser's on to something.
Hey, look, we certainly, our gas tax hasn't been raised in 34 years in Louisiana. It's lost more than half its value in that time due to inflation and cars becoming more fuel efficient. So if we want to resolve our transportation backlog, and I forget what the number is, but it's around $15, $18 mm-hmm. billion dollars. The way to do that, if we really want to get our infrastructure back, we need to pay for that too. And so our gas tax is a lot lower in Louisiana than it is in most states. The price of gas in Louisiana is a lot lower than it is in most states. So I think Louisiana drivers could certainly afford to pay a little bit more at the pump. Nobody's eager to do that, but you make trade-offs. That state government's about trade-offs. And if we want good roads, we have to be willing to pay for them. And I think Mr. Nungesser might have had an interesting idea. I'll put it that way.
Well, one that maybe warrants some more talk. That's what we're here for. But Richard Nelson would like to reduce the top corporate tax rate from 7.5%, which he says is the highest in the South, to 5%. But Stuart Cathy, who's certainly a card-carrying conservative Republican, he says the corporate tax rate looks high, but actually is competitive because of tax breaks. That's from Stuart Cathy.
And I think that's absolutely right. And first of all, we need to remember that most corporations don't pay the corporate income tax. The vast majority of corporations don't pay any at all. So this is a tax that really falls to, you know, a few hundred, maybe a few dozen really large global corporations that pay that corporate income tax. And those corporations and their shareholders are doing very well. So I don't think anybody is refusing to move into Louisiana because we have a corporate income tax. We also have the most generous manufacturing tax incentive anywhere in the country here in Louisiana. It's called the Industrial Tax Exemption Program. So if you come in and build a factory in Louisiana, you get a property tax break from state government here in Louisiana that doesn't exist anywhere else. So when we talk about the taxes that we give to corporations, we also need to talk about all the benefits that we bestow on corporations. So we're already investing a lot of tax breaks and benefits to corporations. We need to do more to talk about how we're going to help people get education, get training, have the health care, transportation, and safe communities that I think will help people thrive.
So is there any chance the 0.45-cent sales tax will be retained?
There is absolutely a chance. Look, the easiest path to resolving this fiscal cliff is to simply renew the taxes that are expired.
Or part of it.
Part of it. And there's three elements of the fiscal cliff. There's the 0.45 sales tax is the biggest. There's also a smaller 2% sales tax on business utilities that was part of the 2018 tax compromise. And then there are vehicle sales taxes that are being shifted from the general fund to the Transportation Trust Fund. The legislature created this fiscal cliff. The legislature can resolve it, and they can do it pretty easily.
Well, we'll keep up to date with Jan Mueller. Thanks for joining us, Sean. And we're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.